Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. And coming up in the programme, the prehistoric time Earth may have had a Saturn-like planetary ring, and how that might have triggered the first mass extinction of life.
If it's able to block out some of the sunlight coming in, it would have cooled the Earth to some extent. And then it's a question of, could we achieve enough cooling to get that really, really extreme cooling that we saw in the Henantian Ice Age? That cooling period coincides quite nicely with the period when the ring might have been shading the Earth.
And the cell biology of choking on your drink.
As I was reading these reviews, I was drinking water and I choked on the water and I started coughing and gagging, trying to get it out of my airways. And I was like, of course this is physiologically relevant. Like, this happens all the time to all of us, but it's just not something that we think about because our bodies are so good about getting out these bad things.
It's not many weeks since much of Europe was sweltering under a near continent-wide heat wave, records being broken, particularly in the Balkans. And then last week, Storm Boris brought exceptional flooding across cities from Poland to Italy, among the most costly event of its type yet, according to the insurance industry. Both were made more likely and more intense by global warming. But the jet stream, that wayward ribbon of high-speed northern hemisphere wind way up in the stratosphere, played a role in both as well, steering different weather systems down below into Europe. It's a constant feature in weather forecasts these days. But what of the past, when they didn't have fancy instrumentation, radar, satellites and so on to track its variations? A paper just published in Nature and led by Valerie Clouet of the University of Arizona has used tree rings to track the fingerprint of the jet stream back to the 14th century to find out.
We studied specifically the influence of jet stream on summer weather, because that's when the trees that we use grow. So the jet stream, these are the winds that blow 10 kilometers above the Earth's surface, but they're a very important controller of what happens to the climate at the Earth's surface. And so in summer, in Europe specifically, how far north or south the jet stream is located determines whether we get a hot and dry summer or a wet and cold summer. And actually, it creates what we call a dipole, as in contrasting weather conditions between the British Isles and the Balkans. When it's wetter and cooler than normal in the Balkans, it's hotter and drier than normal in the British Isles, and vice versa.
And we've seen some pretty extreme examples of heat waves, for example, in just the past few years in Europe, which have, I think, been driven by that.
The summer of 2024 was a really good example of a summer where the jet stream played an important role, because when you look at the temperature map over Europe for the summer of 2024, one, it was the hottest summer on record, but two, most of that heat was located over southeastern Europe. Whereas actually the British Isles were slightly cooler than average. So you see that contrast between those two areas was exactly what happened this summer as well.
Now, what I find remarkable is that obviously there were no direct measures of the jet stream in past centuries, but you've used this kind of weather fingerprint to try and determine the patterns since, I don't know, what, 1300, 1400 or something like that.
That's right, since 1300. So we hypothesized that given that the position of the jet stream is such an important control on temperature in Scotland on the one hand side and in Greece and Italy on the other hand side, if we find tree rings in both of those areas that are also controlled by temperature, then we can use those tree rings, we can combine them, and reconstruct a jet stream over a much longer period of time, basically over as much time as these trees get old. And that's what we tried, and it worked out.
It worked out. I mean, in the sense that you do find that what we see in recent decades, you also see in the past. You, for one thing, see that there was that kind of control from the jet stream. It's always been doing this.
Exactly. And we see that when the jet stream is in more extreme positions, when it's further north than normal or further south than normal, it creates exactly those contrasting conditions between the British Isles and the Balkans that we see over the instrumental period. We know that the jet stream has been creating droughts and wildfires in the Balkans, not just over the past couple of years, but actually over the past 700 years. There's been this recurring pattern of droughts in the Balkans co-occurring with wetter than normal conditions in the British Isles.
The other thing which is important is that you're also, I think, looking at some of the economic data, so crops and so on. And it's not just a matter of scientific curiosity. It's whether this actually has an impact on society.
Exactly. So the cool thing about working in Europe and with European data records is that we don't only have old trees, but we also have been recording all kinds of things for a very long time. So over the past 700 years, we don't only have tree data, but we also have documentary records of what years the grain prices were high, what years grape harvests failed in Italy and Greece, for instance, what years the plague happened in the British Isles, or what years it happened in the Balkans. And so for most of these societal extremes, right, when a plague occurs, it's quite extreme, we find that they were actually also controlled by the jet stream. So the jet stream doesn't just create weather extremes, but it also creates societal extremes, wildfires, harvest failures, epidemics, and so forth.
I mean, what exactly is the connection, from what you're saying, between the plague and the weather?
We show that when the jet stream is further south, was further south in the past, you get more plague occurrences and more mortality in the Balkans, whereas if it's further north than normal, you got more plague and mortality in the British Isles.
I mean, this is something to do with the rainfall, is it?
Exactly, that's exactly it. Cold and rainy conditions make that people stay inside, stay closer together. You know, it's also like when you have a fever, it happens, or when you're you have the flu, it happens more often when the weather's bad. So it must be, I mean, it's related to that, to those cold and wet conditions, creating conditions that are more conducive to epidemics. And that's been shown before, but what has not been shown is that the link with the jet stream over time.
And this is sort of whether you're in the medieval warm period or the Little Ice Age or, you know, sort of more recent decades, this sort of persists.
Yeah, it's consistent. It persists throughout the 700 years. Yep, those events, those extremes in society happen throughout that entire 700-year period. And we see that the jet stream has that control on these events, on these extremes over the entire period, regardless of what era exactly you're in.
I guess this is what you climate scientists call compound events. It's when the weather changes then have impacts on other aspects of our lives. In this case, helping to spread disease.
That's exactly right, yeah. And we see that also, for instance, in the Balkans with wildfires, right? In the when the jet stream was in a northernmost position, you would get hot and dry conditions in the Balkans, and you would get many wildfires because of that condition. And for instance, that's what we saw also this summer, the summer of 2024, where the heat waves and the droughts in the Balkans also created widespread wildfires. And so these compound events, as you rightfully mentioned, that's, I guess, one of the important points from our study. Everything, all of the climate extremes and the societal extremes that we've studied have happened under a jet stream regime, under natural climate variability. So before we started putting CO2 into the atmosphere in massive amounts. And so now you have a climate that's on steroids, climate change, anthropogenic climate change, that's upping the variability in the jet stream. And so all of these extremes that have happened in the past will be enhanced towards the future as well.
The fact that there were extreme episodes in the past is no comfort to the experts worrying how global warming will fuel the extremes of tomorrow. Valerie Clouet there, mirroring a message we heard last week about the half-billion-year history of the extreme ups and downs in global temperatures. And you can hear that again, plus our previous coverage of climate change at the Science in Action webpage at bbcworldservice.com or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Actually, that half-billion-year history of climate change included a detail we didn't touch on last week. A multi-million-year ice age around 460 million years ago in the Ordovician period that led to the first of the great extinction events on the planet. That gets a cosmic explanation this week, that the Earth was briefly encircled by a ring of dust, like Saturn is today, and that the resulting temporary astronomical shade cooled the planet. Where did that dust come from? The proposal is an asteroid, but not one that made a direct hit, like the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 400 million years later. This one was a close shave, according to the speculation of Monash University's Andy Tompkins.
People are probably familiar with the idea that Earth has experienced similar encounters in the past, because the impact that killed the dinosaurs has probably involved a 10-kilometre-sized asteroid. And the one we're talking about here might have been more like 12 kilometres or even slightly bigger. So all we're talking about is a near miss rather than an actual hit in this case.
And when you say near miss, just talk me through that timeline then.
If a body comes close enough, it can pass within what's known as the Roche limit. And inside the Roche limit, passing bodies will be pulled apart by the gravity of the Earth, particularly if they're loosely held together rubble pile asteroids.
And what happens to the broken up body then? I mean, does it then fall down onto Earth in pieces?
If the orbital characteristics are right, it'll break up and some of the bits will stay in orbit and some of them will get flung off and some of them will decay down and land on the Earth and impact the Earth. If everything's just right, you can end up with a ring of debris around the Earth or around any large planet for that matter. That ring will evolve over time to be distributed around the equator.
You say a ring, you mean a ring like the ones we see around, for example, Saturn so famously?
Yeah, that's right. So all of the outer solar system planets, so that's Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus and Neptune, they all have rings and they generally form by the same sort of process. Probably in those cases it would have been an icy moon or an icy large body that broke up when they got too close to the planets.
So it's a very similar kind of idea.
So we've known about this sort of process for a while. It just hasn't been applied to thinking about the Earth much before.
You say, okay, this kind of thing has been seen with other planets. Why were you thinking this has happened? What's the evidence that started you off?
Yeah, so the way I got into this idea and thinking about it in the first place was I had read a scientific paper about the idea that Phobos and Deimos, the moons around Mars, might have formed from rings themselves. And so I thought maybe the Earth had a ring in the past, and then how would I recognise that in the geological record? And then I remembered that people had already recognised that there was a spike in impact cratering rate back in the Ordovician. And so I thought it would be a good idea to go and look at the distribution of where the craters plotted relative to the equator. And so you can use the plate reconstructions that other geologists have done to show the location of all the different plates around the Earth and how it changed over time. And so when we plotted the position of all the craters, they all plotted relatively close to the equator. And so it's pretty hard to explain that sort of distribution by any sort of normal cratering mechanism. And so it's more likely that it probably formed from a body that was captured around the Earth.
So this would have been the big lumps would have now and again, they would have come in sort of what, immediately after the breakup or over the next, I don't know, thousands or millions of years?
At the same time, there were some sedimentary rocks being laid down around the Earth at different places. And those sedimentary limestones contain meteorite debris. That's how we know when it started happening, because earlier sediments don't have any meteorite debris. Then all of a sudden we see 100 to 1,000 times as much meteorite debris accumulating in sediments. So we know that some fell to the surface straight away, and some of the impact craters date to that same age as those sediments were accumulating. And then that spike in impact cratering rate lasted for on the order of 20 to 40 million years or so.
So these aren't as big as the impact craters at the end of the period of the dinosaurs, but these would have been sort of impressive, I take it.
Yeah, they would have been impressive. So they're actually fairly small craters by comparison with the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. You're right. These are sort of a kilometre across, up to 20 kilometres across or so. 4 or 5 kilometres is more common for those ones.
The other thing which really interested me about your paper, last week we talked about a 485 million year history of temperature on the planet. And at about 460 to 440 million years ago, we didn't talk about this, there was a very abrupt cold period. And you're suggesting that somehow this asteroid may be to do with that.
Yeah, that's right. That's probably the more speculative part of the paper because we don't really know how opaque the ring might have been. If it's able to block out some of the sunlight coming in, it would have cooled the Earth to some extent. And then it's a question of could we achieve enough cooling to get that really, really extreme cooling that we saw in the Henantian Ice Age you're talking about there. So it's that cooling period coincides quite nicely with the period when the ring might have been shading the Earth. So it might well be possible.
Now, you may have noticed we like to connect the dots here on Science in Action, and a few months back we brought an entire edition from an astronomical conference planning for the close approach in 2029 of asteroid Apophis and how to measure what Earth's gravity will do to it. We know it will miss the Earth, but I wanted reassurance from Andy it won't come so close that it could break up like that Ordovician asteroid.
That's right. So it's about twice the Roche limit. It would be interesting if it did come within that Roche limit. It would be quite spectacular to see an asteroid breaking up and dispersing all over the place. Some of your listeners might remember Shoemaker-Levy 9 that broke up around Jupiter and by the same process and caused a chain of impact craters on Jupiter.
Absolutely. I do remember that. Very spectacular when it happened, 30 years ago, I guess. But one of the things that the astronomers we spoke to were very interested in was how much Apophis would sort of creak under Earth's gravity as opposed to actually falling apart. Would that help you constrain your models?
That would be really interesting to know, actually. Like, would the light dust on the surface of the asteroid just float off a little bit? That'd be really interesting to know.
And those of you who are paying close attention to the astronomy news, you should be aware that Earth has temporarily acquired an extra moon, another asteroid, 2024 PT5, that has briefly been snared by Earth's gravity, a bit like a leaf caught in a whirlpool in a stream. And that, too, is relevant to Andy's hypothesis.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that makes it easy to form a ring around the Earth, actually, because a mini moon is moving slower relative to the Earth. It's more likely to be captured as it gets close if it comes within that Roche limit. And we know that mini moons are captured and then lost again fairly regularly. So it's a matter of capturing a large mini moon, breaking up around the Earth, and then persisting long enough to form a ring.
But this one's sort of, rather than being broken up by our gravity, it's just sort of momentarily caught by it for a single orbit or so around us, and then it's going to fly off into the distance somewhere.
That's right. So most mini moons are caught and stay at much further distances away than the Roche limit. Just occasionally they get close enough to be passed within that distance.
Strange bodies passing in the night. Well, that's what we hope, at least. Getting too close sounds like bad news for our home planet. Andy Tompkins' proposal was just published by Earth and Planetary Science Letters, and he actually was involved in another headline-grabbing study showing how earthquakes concentrate gold nuggets. That's what I call valuable science. Talking gold, biologist Laura Seeholzer has just won the 2024 Eppendorf Prize for an essay she wrote for Science magazine describing studies she'd done to work out the role of rare but apparently important cells scattered around our upper and lower airways, work that was also formally published in Science early this year. The true delight of presenting Science in Action is that every week I'm learning about things I've never heard of before, and they're always captivating. Add to that list, neuroendocrine cells.
Neuroendocrine really it's a kind of a catch-all term for a cell that has both the ability to communicate with the nervous system, but also release potentially peptides that can act like hormones. So they come in many different flavors. But when I started this project, I was really interested in the cells that were in the lung. And these are well-known cells because they turn into small cell lung cancer. So there's a lot of interest in research on them. kind of along the way, I realized that these sounds weren't just in the lung, but they were also in our trachea and our larynx. And when I first started looking at this, I wasn't even sure if what I was looking at in the larynx were neuroendocrine cells because there were so few reports about them.
So you happened on something really quite new in a way, despite the fact they've been there all the time. And as I understand it, they're sort of rare and sort of poking out in between all the other cells into the airway.
Yeah, they have this very beautiful morphology where they have this little nose that's sticking out into the airway, and then they send this other little projection down to where the sensory neurons are. As somebody who's an electrophysiologist, the first thing that I did was basically tear apart the tissue and get all these cells into individual cells on a dish so then I could record them, listen to their electrical activity.
So you just attach electrodes effectively, and then in the paper you talk about them sensing water or acids, is that right?
So the first thing that I did was, yeah, essentially attach a very tiny electrode onto them, and I realized that they behave much more like a neuron than they do like any other epithelial cell on your skin or in your airways. So that immediately got me hooked on them, that they fire action potentials like a neuron and they behave much more like a neuron. Then I started searching for what they could be sensing, and we hit a lot of dead ends. After months of this, I was getting very frustrated. So I came into my boss, David Julius's office, and I was just telling him about all the things that I had tried, all this failure that I was having. And he's like, okay, let's take a step back. When he talks, he kind of like hangs on his couch and he has his like hands on his head. He's like, okay, what could these cells be sensing? And then we just start thinking about what this region of the airway is doing. And we realized that really one of its most important functions is that it prevents bad things from getting into our lungs. So have you ever had the experience of drinking water and it goes down the wrong pipe?
Oh, many, many times. Particularly if I'm talking too much while drinking.
Yes. So we realized that water and also gastric acid, so if you're refluxing acid up your esophagus, if it gets down into your airways, it's incredibly painful. So we realized that these were very common and very potent noxious stimuli for the airways. So I went and then I tested whether they activate these cells. And it was really this, as I write in the essay, it was this aha moment where I realized that they strongly and reproducibly activated these cells. So then we started thinking about these cells as this surveillance system within the larynx and the trachea that exist in order to detect these bad things. And then we wanted to test whether they were communicating with the nervous system. So we did a series of experiments to basically figure out whether they were talking to sensory neurons. They were, and we wanted to figure out exactly how they were talking to sensory neurons. And in kind of one of the more surprising and fun experiments that I did in the course of this research was we have this in mouse neurobiology. These studies were done in mice. In mouse neurobiology, we can express this special protein that when you shine light on it, it causes the cell to become activated. It's called optogenetics.
This is where you can actually trigger it with light rather than messing around with water or acid. You've got a much more kind of control.
Exactly. So when you shine light, only your cells are activated. And it's just this really reductionist way of testing what a cell is doing. So I shined light on the mouse's larynx and trachea, and they immediately started doing these airway protective reflexes, like these swallows and these cough-like reflexes that mice have.
So you were really proving that this was a closed loop, that they were sentinel cells that then send the message. I mean, does it go straight to the muscles in the larynx, or does it go up to the brain, or is that a dumb question?
No, not at all. So they released this neurotransmitter called ATP, which you can often think of as the energy of a cell, but it's also used as a way, it's a form of communication between different neurons or between different cells. So they release ATP and then it activates a very specific type of sensory neuron. That sensory neuron sends information up to the brainstem, and then there's motor programs that are then activated to drive these reflexes.
Yeah, when you're trying to cough up the water, when you're trying to spit out the acid.
Mm-hmm.
that's sort of an automatic, almost automatic process that's triggered. And one nice thing is that it's so relatable, this sense of choking or coughing and so on. So you start off with something quite abstruse, like a rare type of cell, and you end up, I think, telling a story that everyone understands.
Thank you. It was exciting that it was something so physiologically relevant. And at one point, there was a reviewer who was questioning whether such low osmolar solution or such low pH was physiologically relevant for the airways. And as I was reading these reviews, I was drinking water and I choked on the water. And I started coughing and gagging, trying to get it out of my airways. And I was like, of course this is physiologically relevant. Like, this happens all the time to all of us. But it's just not something that we think about because our bodies are so good about getting out these bad things out of our airways.
And in a sense, I suppose we should, yes, appreciate that protecting our lungs is not a nuisance. It's actually quite life-saving.
Yes, exactly. If you can't get water, and especially if you can't get acidic solutions out, it can really do some damage on your airways. So it can cause the cells that make up your lung to die. It can impair your ability to oxygenate your blood. There's a lot of bad things that can happen. I think the other most common thing that happens is often when you're, especially in the case of gastric reflux, when you're refluxing acid, you're also refluxing all of the other nasty contents of your stomach. So this is a common form of aspiration pneumonia, which is a fairly prevalent problem in intensive care units in hospitals.
It's interesting that you went from a completely blank slate. You were sort of almost flying blind, trying
completely,
to understand
yeah.
what these cells were. And then I don't know what the timeline was when it all started making sense, but was it like sort of coming into bright sun and suddenly understanding it?
It absolutely was. There was kind of this moment in my postdoctoral fellowship where I was in David's office kind of in despair because, you know, if I can't figure out what these cells are sensing, I am never going to be able to put together a study on them. And then, you know, I'll have to think of something new to do or something new to study. So it's this really pivotal moment when we were coming up with a new way of studying these cells. And then everything just kind of fell into place after that.
I mean, was that why you chose to write this prize-winning essay as well as doing the sort of the serious academic paper to sort of share that sense of excitement when suddenly something becomes clear?
Yeah, and writing the essay was also so much of how I spend my time thinking about science is in order to communicate with other scientists. And that doesn't always translate into talking to my mom about my science, who, you know, she's been around scientists all her life, but she herself is not a scientist. So when I was writing the essay, I was thinking, if I was going to sit down and have a cup of coffee with my mom, how would I tell her about what I'm doing? And how would I get her excited and take her on this journey that really was my postdoc? Because how I lay out the essay is really how the research unfolded.
Laura Seeholzer, Helen Hay Whitney Fellow in the Julius Lab at the University of California, San Francisco, and eager, it seems, to dig further into this sensory biology. We talked a bit longer, of course, but the rest, I'm afraid, was just for Laura, for me, Ren and Peace, and for producer Jonathan Blackwell. But BBC Science in Action will be back with more Secrets of the Universe next week, and we'll share as much as we have time for.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.